This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Worried about high oil prices and exploding nuclear plants? Carry on, shoppers, because we've found gold right under our feet, a bonanza of natural gas. Yes, fracking will fill your tank, heat your house, and light up the streets for another 100 years. At least, that's what we've been told. A new report out from the Post Carbon Institute pokes a sharp pin in the natural gas bubble. We'll hear from energy analyst David Hughes. But first, a return guest to Radio EcoShock, Mr. Richard Heinberg. He woke me up to peak oil with his 2003 book, The Party's Over, and helped found a community of alternative thought in 2005 with his book, Power Down, Options and Actions for the Post-Carbon World. We interviewed Richard on the future of coal in his book, Blackout, and now he's written a hot introduction to the alleged Great Age of Gas, available online from the Post-Carbon Institute. We catch up with Richard Heinberg in New York after one of his many public talks. Hello, Richard, and welcome again to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. It's good to be with you.
It's very nice that you've joined us today. We have some things to talk about, but before we slay the mythology of saving ourselves with fracked gas, tell us why you were invited to speak at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts.
Oh, well, that was a wonderful occasion. What happened was Worcester Polytechnic had invited Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, to give their commencement address. That's probably because Exxon gives a ton of money every year to WPI. Anyway, the students heard about this, and a number of them were kind of upset to hear that in one of the students' words, Rex Tillerson of ExxonMobil was going to be giving them well wishes for their future when his company is busy undermining those futures. So they organized an alternative commencement ceremony after the main one, and they invited me to come and give the alternative commencement address.
And what sorts of things did you talk to them about, just briefly?
Well, I'm usually not one to excoriate individual fossil fuel companies because they're sort of all in the same boat. But on this occasion, I sort of had to go after ExxonMobil a little bit. They've funded climate denial campaigns for years. There was a 2007 report from the Union of Concerned Scientists that showed how they had organized the same PR companies that had done the opposition to tobacco regulation back in the 1980s, claiming that tobacco was just fine for you, no problem. And now, of course, they've hired those same companies to argue that we really don't know if the climate is changing or if it is, whether it's due to fossil fuels, maybe because it's cow farts or the sun's getting hotter, who knows. They've been very effective at that because here in the United States, one of our two main political parties has made climate change denial a litmus test for its candidates. So we've effectively shut off any possibility of climate legislation in the United States for the foreseeable future. So this was a huge success for ExxonMobil, but it's a tragedy for democracy, for the Earth, and for the next generation.
Well, let's get to that natural gas boom. I've heard several speeches by David Hughes. His new downloadable report from the Post Carbon Institute is called Will Natural Gas Fuel America in the 21st Century? First of all, Richard, who said that it would and what was promised?
Well, this notion that fracking gas, let me first say that this is a relatively new technology that was applied first with oil fields drilling in very impermeable rocks. So we're talking about rock where it's very difficult for the natural gas molecules to migrate toward the borehole. And so what they do is, using explosives and chemicals and horizontal drilling, they open up that impervious rock so that the natural gas can migrate up the well. This is expensive. It's environmentally problematic. Now, who said that it's going to be our savior? Well, it started with the gas fracking companies themselves. And there are a number of companies like Chesapeake Energy that has specialized in this kind of drilling. And they made enormous claims at first. And then that was taken up by the U.S. Department of Energy almost uncritically. And then after the DOE made its flawed assessment, then, of course, that was picked up by the news media. We saw big shows on 60 Minutes and other news programs on television, cover stories in Time magazine and other magazines. And then a number of mainstream environmental organizations decided that with all of this fracking gas for 100 years, well, we might as well use that to transition away from coal because, you know, if you burn natural gas, it produces fewer carbon emissions at the point of combustion. So this was thought of as being then a transition fuel away from coal to help with the climate problem. So in our report, we look at all of these assumptions and assertions, and we find very little to support them.
Well, could you walk us through your first three assumptions that you mentioned in your introduction, maybe starting with assumption number one? What was that?
Well, the assumption that we have a lot, well, yes, that's true, but it's going to be produced relatively slowly. The next assumption is that it's going to be cheap. Well, the reason natural gas prices are cheap right now is that we had heroic rates of drilling about 3 years ago. Natural gas prices were much higher then. Just before the big crash in 2008, we were seeing natural gas prices in the range of $14 a 1,000 cubic feet. Prices are down now to about $4 a 1,000 cubic feet because of a momentary glut in supply from those heroic rates of drilling. But prices are not going to stay at these levels as we run through that momentary glut. And the reason we're going to do that is because, as David Hughes will explain, natural gas fracking wells deplete very rapidly. So we're going to need very, very high rates of drilling, and that's going to be expensive, and that's going to force the price of gas back up.
Well, you know, I live in a rather old condo building, and people here were talking about putting up dual-pane glass and doing some more insulating and everything, but then the price of natural gas went down. We saved $20,000 or more on our heating bill, and people think that's going to keep going. You can see how this really changes the public dialogue to suddenly say, oh, we've got some cheap, clean fuel. Is it really that clean? I mean, let's talk about this idea of it's going to save us from climate change.
Right. This was another area we explored in the report. Now, this is based on work that was done at Cornell University and came out in a report about 3 weeks ago by a scientist named Howarth. We actually updated some of his research because it had immediately been attacked by the industry. And, of course, the reason it was attacked was that he questioned this fundamental assumption that fracking gas is going to be better for the climate. Now, natural gas is mostly methane, which is the simplest hydrocarbon molecule. And methane happens to be about 20 times worse than carbon dioxide in terms of its greenhouse footprint. The problem with fracking gas is there is typically a release of some of that methane into the atmosphere through the process of fracking and producing the gas. And it's enough of a release, it's called fugitive methane, it's enough of a release that over time the greenhouse gas emissions from fracking gas production are actually worse than the greenhouse gas emissions from coal. This is a life cycle assessment. So in other words, if you look at the entire process from exploration and production through combustion, that whole process, it's actually worse for fracking gas than it is for the coal cycle.
And for a long time, the industry wouldn't even tell us what they were pumping deep down underground, possibly into our water supplies. Do we know now what's in those fracking gas fluids?
Not entirely. Some of these cocktails are still proprietary. The chemicals are toxic. They're making their way, in some cases, into groundwater supplies. There are well-documented situations where people have, you know, gone to the hospital with toxic effects from these chemicals, and doctors say, well, you know, what were you exposed to? And the companies refuse to say.
You know, it almost reminds me of a kind of Ponzi scheme thing, because we often said about nuclear power, it's going to take just one big plant blowing up in the Western world to possibly finish off this industry and take away a huge power supply. And I'm wondering if it isn't the same with natural gas. If we poison, for example, the water supply of New York City but with the Marcellus shale fracking, just one big accident like that could bring this industry to a screeching halt. Is that possible?
Well, yes, that's possible, but I think it's a bubble in any case, because we're probably going to be seeing declining production of natural gas in the U.S. over the next few years rather than increasing supplies, just because of the declining rates of drilling that have occurred since about 2007. Now, you know, that theoretically could be reversed if we saw, once again, very, very high rates of drilling, but that would require much higher gas prices. It's a situation where we're unlikely to see exactly what we've been promised. We've been promised lots of natural gas at low prices. We're either going to see less gas or we're going to see much more expensive gas. And one way or the other, it's going to result in a much smaller benefit to our energy economy than has been promised.
I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Richard Heinberg from the Post Carbon Institute, and they have a new report out about natural gas. Richard wrote the introduction, and the report is written by David Hughes, who worked with the Canadian Geological Society for 32 years, so he really knows his stuff. So how did you and David Hughes come together on this project? Tell us a little bit about the Post Carbon Institute and why this report now.
Well, David and I are both fellows of the Post Carbon Institute, and the Institute's function, really, goal is to help us chart our way through the end of the fossil fuel age. It's axiomatic that the fossil fuel age will come to an end because these fuels are finite, they're non-renewable resources, and we have pursued the practice of harvesting the low-hanging fruit first. So even though there are still lots of hydrocarbon molecules in the Earth's crust, there's still lots more oil, natural gas, and coal. The reality is that we're in a situation where now, where every new increment is going to be more costly to produce, and it's going to have greater environmental impact. In the world of oil, we saw that in the Gulf of Mexico last year with the Deepwater Horizon disaster. We were drilling in a mile of ocean water in a situation where the oil industry was operating at the very edge of its capacity. And, of course, accidents will happen in those situations. But we're seeing it also with fracking gas. We're seeing it also increasingly with coal, where even though we're mining more coal than we were a few years ago, we're actually getting only about the same amount of energy from it because we're mining lower and lower quality ores. So this transition away from fossil fuels is inevitable, and we at Post Carbon Institute want to help society find the fastest, most effective way of making that transition.
Well, that really leads to my next question, which is, are you just a band of people who are against energy? I mean, if we can't have fossil fuels and nuclear is maybe too dangerous, you do have some positive recommendations about what we should do. Where can our listeners find those answers?
Well, on our website, we have a number of reports, including one called Searching for a Miracle, in which we analyzed 18 different energy sources according to 10 criteria. And I won't try to summarize the whole entire report here. It's about 75 pages long. It's a free PDF download. But there are a number of viable alternative renewable energy sources that deserve attention and development. But also, we have come to the conclusion that energy conservation, meaning increasing efficiency of use and also finding ways simply to reduce energy use in all the ways we use energy, from the food system to the transport system, our buildings, and more, these are going to be the strategies that we will need to turn to first and foremost. They're the fastest, they're the cheapest, they're the most effective. And as energy gets more expensive, we'll have to do it anyway.
And you've got the book, The Post-Carbon Reader, Managing the 21st Century Sustainability Crisis. Is that available online, or do we get it as a book? What's the situation there?
Well, you can download chapters from that book. Each of our 28 fellows contributed a chapter to that book. And it's about all of the aspects of the transition away from fossil fuels. It's that transition is going to have impacts on, again, on our financial system, transport system, energy system, food system, and more. So all of those dimensions are explored in the book, and you can download chapters free from postcarbon.org, or you can purchase the printed book, which is quite a wonderful book. It's being used as a textbook in sustainability classes all over North America now, and you can find out more about that at the website.
Back when I started Radio EcoShock in 2006, I got an email from a fellow who wrote this mysterious thing called the Muse-letter, and I've been subscribed to it and reading it ever since. Can you tell our listeners how they get that and what it is?
Sure. That's a monthly email essay from myself. I've been writing Muse-letter since 1992. So my own intellectual journey through sustainability has been charted through the pages of Muse-letter, and if folks want to subscribe, it's free. And you can just go to richardheinberg.com and follow the link to Muse-letter and sign up.
And as we close up, is there something new coming up you'd like to tell us just a bit about?
Well, yes, I just finished a book called The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. And it's a rather large story. It's a big book. It's coming out late this summer from New Society Publishers. Actually, the e-book will be out in just a few weeks. And it looks at how the end of cheap energy, declining availability of non-renewable resources, increasing costs of environmental impacts, and limits to debt are all converging to choke off world economic growth and more or less force us to find new objectives to work toward other than expansion of GDP, like gross national happiness and finding better ways to live rather than bigger ways to consume.
I'm looking forward to reading that. I'd like to get a review copy when I can, and maybe we can have you back on the show to talk about it.
I'll make sure you get one, Alex.
This is fantastic. Okay, we've been talking with Richard Heinberg. He helped wake me up to the whole peak oil situation, and he's gone on to become a pretty thorough energy analyst and speaking around the world, I would say, and he's certainly been in a lot of films. You're going to see him in all kinds of films. There's Richard Heinberg telling us about what's coming up in the post-carbon future. So be sure and tune in to Post Carbon Institute and find out more about that. Thank you so much, Richard Heinberg.
It's been a pleasure, Alex. Thanks so much.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We'll be right back with what everybody needs to know about natural gas, but first, this fracking song.
Fracking is a form of natural gas drilling, an alternative to oil, because the oil caps fill and bringing jobs to small towns. So everybody's willing, people turn on the lights, and the drill is making killing.
Water goes into the pipe into the ground. The pressure crank stretches 7,000 feet down. The cracks release the gas that powers your town. That will frack, yeah, totally frack.
But there's more in the water than just H2O. Toxic chemicals help to make the fluid flow. With names like benzene and formaldehyde, you better keep a phone away from the water supply.
The drillers say the fishes are a mile below. The groundwater pumped into American homes, but don't tell it to the residents of Sublet Wayo, that was frack. They're talking benzene.
What the frack is going on? With all this fracking going on, I think we need some facts to come to light. I know we want our energy, but nothing ever comes for free. I think my water's on fire tonight.
So the name goes back to 2005. Bush said gas drillers didn't have to comply with the Safe Drinking Water Act before too long. It was fracking, fracking till the break of dawn.
With the EPA out, it was up to the states, but they didn't have the money to investigate. Said people couldn't breathe, fracking was to blame. All the while, water was going up in flames.
Cause it's hard to contain all the methane release. It can get into the air, it can get into the streams. It's a greenhouse gas worth the CO2. Fracking done wrong, things can finally change too.
Now it's not that drillers should never be fracking, but the current regulation is severely lacking. Reducing toxins contain the gas and wastewater, and the people will get sick, and the planet will get hot.
What the frack is going on? With all this fracking going on, I think we need some facts to come to light. I know we want our energy, but nothing ever comes for free. I think my world is on fire
tonight. My Water's on Fire Tonight, that's the title, or the fracking song. Find it on YouTube. It's from Studio 20 at NYU and ProPublica. A survey of prices by the U.S. government found gas and food prices went up 19% just in 2010. Canada will be about the same. It's a huge jump. Maybe you've noticed. Now everybody needs to know where energy comes from and what the real options are. Should you buy a new car? Will you be able to afford to drive it 5 years from now? Is it time to move near transit to a place with low energy bills or out to the country to grow your own food? I'm going to play you a short lesson on natural gas, what we have and what we don't, from geoscientist David Hughes. After working with the Canadian Government Geological Survey of Canada for 32 years, Dave Hughes is touring with his talk about peak resources. We only have time this week for a short selection from his review of natural gas, taken from a speech to Transition Toronto on February 3, 2011. In a coming show, I'll add Dave's shocking data on depleting oil and coal, and a link to the full speech as a free MP3 download. Here is David Hughes on natural gas.
Campbell's forecast of combined oil and gas, if you convert natural gas to its oil equivalent, suggesting that there's not enough energy in natural gas to offset declines in energy lost from oil after peak oil, and a combined oil and gas peak about now, 2010. Natural gas itself, Campbell's forecast, suggests that natural gas won't peak until much further out than oil, roughly 2045. The story of natural gas is a story about depletion. When you drill a conventional gas well, the first year decline is typically about 30% per year. In 2007, 60% of Canadian production came from wells drilled in the last 6 years. So the story of gas is you have to keep drilling to keep production flat or growing. We've also witnessed a decline in the quality of the average gas well in Canada. So we need more and more wells to equal an older well. In 1995, the average initial productivity of an Alberta gas well was about 600 MCF a day. That declined by 72% up until 2005. So we need nearly four average gas wells today to equal one average gas well in the mid-90s. And that's what I call the exploration treadmill. More and more drilling to keep production flat. National Energy Board forecast, short-term, out to 2012, suggesting that gas production will continue to decline, even with the much-vaunted shale gas. U.S. gas production, 1991 to 2010. It turns out the all-time peak in U.S. gas production was in 1973. Because of shale gas, production has been growing recently, almost back to the 1973 peak. This is where production would have to get to meet the EIA 2035 forecast. The story of decline in the U.S. is even worse than in Canada. If you didn't drill a gas well in the U.S., production would decline about 32% per year. 60% of 2006 production in the U.S. came from gas wells drilled in the previous 4 years. The number of wells completed in the U.S. versus gas production. Throughout the 90s, the U.S. drilled about 10,000 gas wells per year. That increased to nearly 35,000 gas wells in the 2006 to 2009 timeframe. The Great Recession hit, Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. The number of gas wells declined, but not anywhere close to the previous historical levels. There's still quite a few tie-ins yet to be done from this bubble of drilling. So they tripled the number of gas wells they drilled. They grew production by about 15%. The current strength of U.S. gas production and low prices, in my view, are related to delayed tie-ins from the drilling boom of 2006 to 2009. Drilling commitments required to maintain leases. You lose land if you don't drill. The need to maintain cash flow. And many of these companies had favorable hedging contracts at fairly high prices. Reduced demand, particularly in the industrial sector, due to the Great Recession. And in my view, these issues will be sorted out over the next year or two. We'll find out what the real potential of shale gas is.
Radio EcoShock.
Shale gas has been touted as the great white hope. Replace the vehicle fleet with natural gas-powered vehicles. T. Boone Pickens has signed on to this. There's a lot of shale in North America. Most of what we know about shale gas, however, comes from the Barnett shale play in East Texas. There's been a huge amount of hype on shale gas. One of the major hype artists is Aubrey McClendon, the CEO of Chesapeake, which is one of the major shale gas producers in the U.S. McClendon testified to Congress in 2008, and this is what he said, among other things. I believe natural gas can and should be the driving force for how this Congress can take bold action to free our country from a death grip of high prices for imported oil, thereby improving our economy, enhancing national security, and helping the environment. I believe U.S. natural gas producers can increase supplies by 5% per year for at least the next decade, and that assumes there's no more access to public lands and waters than there is today. Compounded, that's 63% growth in 10 years. That's a tall statement. The U.S. Potential Gas Committee signed on, and in 2009 added 616 trillion cubic feet of shale gas to U.S. gas reserves. Not to be outdone, the EIA, in its latest forecast published in November, or actually December of 2010, suggested shale gas could quintuple in production by 2035. We don't need Canadian imports, and we don't even need the Alaska gas pipeline. We've got so much shale gas. Just to show you where the EIA has come on shale gas over the last 3 years, its 2008 forecast, about 4 trillion cubic feet per year of shale gas, 2009, 6 trillion, 2010, 12 trillion. 45% of U.S. production will be shale gas by 2035. Is that realistic? Some would say no. Arthur Berman is a geologist and analyst in Houston, one of the biggest critics of shale gas, and he's spent a lot of time looking at several thousand wells in the Barnett, decline rates, ultimate recoverable, and so forth. And this is what Berman said in October. Shale plays are marginally commercial at best. Average well life is much shorter than predicted, and the volume of commercially recoverable gas has been greatly overstated. The plays have consistently contracted to a core area that represents 10 to 20% of the resource that was initially claimed. The manufacturing model has failed. In the early days of shale gas, we were told that geology doesn't matter anymore. These plays are homogeneous, and we can drill anywhere and get uniform levels of production. These are not low-cost plays. The marginal cost of production for most companies is $7.50 an MCF. Gas price today is about $4.50. Reserves have been greatly overstated, and 80% of booked reserves are undeveloped. By late 2009, even Aubrey McClendon recognized the fact that shale plays are not homogeneous, and they do have core areas that are much better than other areas. And McClendon said this in October 2009. There was a time when you were told that any of the 17 counties in the Barnett Shale Play would be just as good as any other county. We found out that there are two or two and a half counties where you really want to be. The Haynesville Shale in Louisiana, same thing, retracted to a core area of about 10% of the initial area. The Haynesville was once touted as the fourth largest gas pool in the world. The story of shale plays is a story about very steep decline rates. First year decline rates in the Haynesville are about 85%. In the Barnett, they're 65%. So if anything, shale plays will accelerate the exploration treadmill, the number of wells that have to be drilled to keep production flat. These are not low-cost wells. The average well in the Haynesville is about $10 million. In the Barnett, 2 to 4 million per well. These wells use 2 to 5 million gallons of water and are very complex. This is a frack job in the Barnett, just to show you the energy intensity of shale gas. 39 pumper trucks here. There's dozens to hundreds of water trucks that have to haul in the water for these hydraulic fractures. Very interesting study out of Cornell comparing the full cycle emissions of shale gas wells to coal. By Bob Howarth. And if you look at things like CO2 emissions, drilling and completing the wells, and at fugitive methane emissions from pipelines and the wells themselves, Howarth suggests that shale gas on a full cycle basis could be worse than coal from a greenhouse gas emission point of view. The gas lobby would tell you, well, we only look at burner tip emissions. And in theory, burner tip emissions from gas are half the CO2 emissions of coal. But clearly, we have to look at the full cycle impact of shale gas.
We're out of time. That was Canadian geoscientist David Hughes speaking to Transition Toronto on February 3, 2011. Check out his new report, Will Natural Gas Fuel America in the 21st Century? With a foreword by Richard Heinberg at postcarbon.org. Hear David Hughes on oil and coal in an upcoming show, and stay tuned for more Radio EcoShock.